love your work. On this show, we help you find success on your own terms. I'm David Cadavy. I've been a creative entrepreneur for more than 10 years. I've written a couple best-selling books, Design for Hackers, and now The Heart to Start. If you are new here, welcome. Again, I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app and get my free creative productivity toolkit. Sign up at cadavy.net/tools. Charlie Hone was on top of the world. He was working with popular authors like Tim Ferriss and Ramit Sethi, and he was helping launch books to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. The problem was, Charlie was kind of miserable. His need to succeed drove him to sacrifice sleep, and it drove him to abusing performance-enhancing drugs. His body was breaking down, and he became crippled with anxiety. Eventually, Charlie found a way out of anxiety and a way to not just a healthy work-life balance, but to a healthy work-life integration. Charlie's secret weapon? Play. Now, if you're anything like me, your initial thought is, huh? Play? I don't need to play. I'm an adult. But Charlie is such an advocate of play that he's written two books about it, Play It Away and Play for a Living. And in this playful conversation with Charlie, you're going to find out, what does Charlie mean by play? I hadn't realized how central play was to my life and work until I had this conversation. And how can play actually help you build skills? Being playful can sharpen your skills in reaching goals. And how did Charlie overcome workaholism and adjust to a healthy relationship with a high-profile life? We'll also talk about what Charlie learned working with Tim Ferriss, how to think up irresistible book titles, and the power of improv. Myself and many of you are thinking more about self-sufficiency and emergency preparedness, which is why I'm thrilled that my friend John, who we recently spoke with on episode 115, has created theprepared.com. You don't have to look far to see that most people are unprepared for things like car accidents and natural disasters. The Prepared is a totally free site full of practical information, but The Prepared doesn't have any of the normal prepper propaganda or weirdness. I learned it's easy to cover the basics for emergencies like fires, earthquakes, and hurricanes. I even use The Prepared to buy the right respirator mask for those days when there's really high air pollution where I live. So check out theprepared.com. That's theprepared.com. Now, here's Charlie Hone. I'm here with Charlie Hone, and Charlie, you have this book, Play for a Living. And, you know, honestly, when I first saw that book and I saw, oh, this is a book about play, I kind of was thinking like, oh, maybe that's not the book for me. But the more that I've learned about the book, or actually reading the book, I realized that you're talking about something that's very, very important to me. So maybe it was just that I misunderstood. So what is your definition of play?
Sure. And that's a common reaction, I think, to the word play as adults. We're like, childish. No, not for me. Kind of a weird, you know, because you meet people who are like, yeah, I'm just so playful, and they're kind of hippie woo-woo. But my definition of play is really the thing that you, the activities that you're most drawn to just naturally when you're a kid, when no one is forcing you to do them, no one is grading you, no one is paying you money, that you're doing them because that's who you are. And remaining playful throughout your life in carrying that spirit of this is a game almost. This is something I would do no matter what is really important because, I mean, they've done actual studies at this point finding that the strongest motivators for high performance, it goes in this order: play, purpose, and then profit, basically. So You perform at your best when you approach something playfully as though it's a game and there's no reward except your intrinsic reward, or what you talk about, loving the work itself. And then that's followed by, okay, there's a reason I'm doing this. It's important. We're going to the moon or Mars or whatever. And then followed by, okay, I'm just doing this for the paycheck. I'm doing this to eventually escape the rat race, or doing it to work for the weekend, so to speak.
Yeah, and that definition makes so much sense to me because that was, you know, when I started on my own 10 years ago, that was like the one thing that I wanted to do, was reconnect with, I guess, a sense of play, a sense of wanting to do this thing, of enjoying this thing. You know, I was thinking that it was all about playing Frisbee or something like that, which I'm sure is a component of it. How do you think about that? The difference between I'm playing to intentionally disconnect and I'm playing to as a part of my work. How do you think about that separation?
Yeah. So I think the problem, what we're kind of talking about now is like work-life balance, which I think is a concept that people have to think about when they don't like their work. And what I'm trying to emphasize is work-life integration, like work-play integration. It is all life, right? And so working on something is it's not fundamentally completely different from play because you're still doing, you're just being. And so work to me can be approached playfully. It can be something that you would do even if you weren't getting paid. And the whole point of Play for a Living was pointing out all these people who embodied that and actually viewed their work as their own game. To answer the question about how do I think about Frisbee and stuff, well, that's just a part of what I do. And it's a game that I like to play, and it's how I also de-stress. It's how I exercise. It's how I move. It's how I maintain good mental health so I can continue doing the work that I really love and being good at that. So it's all part of the same thing, which is how do you live in a way that's aligned with who you are?
You know, it's funny. I feel like I'm somebody who, like, even when I'm playing, whether it's like I'm on a trip somewhere or I'm like salsa dancing or I'm at an improv workshop, for me, there's like, and this is a little perverse in a way, but like, for me, it's like there's always, I'm kind of doing this because I know it's going to make me better at my creative work, it seems
doing it for purpose.
Yeah, I'm a little embarrassed to admit it almost because it sounds like, oh man, you're like, you were seriously constantly working because even your play is part of your work. But for me, it's not like to de-stress. It's because I enjoy my work. I can see how for some people maybe play is more to disconnect because they do have a more unpleasant day.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any such thing as right or wrong in this definition, right? For some people, they're like, no, I have my hobby, which is tennis, and I have my job, which is being a surgeon. And they're two totally separate things. And I play tennis to take my mind off of the hardships of my work or, you know, that sort of thing. There's different modalities of work where you could be in a job where you're performing a repetitive sort of mindless task, which those jobs will obviously go away someday. But if you're in that kind of job, it's usually not a very playful one for you. So you use play as something totally different to de-stress from that job and to do something maybe more creative and to use another part of your brain or your body. Can you hear my baby in the background?
Yes, she did. Is your baby playing right now?
She is. Everything is 100% play for her.
Great. So, I mean, how has that experience been? You're a new father. Has that made you think more about play, seeing the way that a child interacts with the world?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have no interactions with her that aren't playful. And she's 9 months old, and I think fortunately I learned about the benefits of play and the evolutionary reason why human beings play more than just about any other species is that's kind of the other aspect of play is all the stuff we just talked about is like, I'm sure some people are thinking, oh, that's nice to have, but I live in the real world. I have to pay bills. You know, I have a family, I have debt, whatever. But there's an evolutionary reason why human beings are so playful. It helps us develop empathy and compassion and skills that helped us survive. It helps us attract mates. You know, one of the most attractive features of a potential mate for both sexes is, are they playful? Being playful displays that you are mentally healthy. It displays that you can be safe around children so that you can be a good long-term mate. Play has all these, I mean, it has all these benefits to us as a species that allowed us to evolve in tribes and to shape the world in the way that we did. I mean, everything is the fruit of play in our society in many ways. And but with my baby daughter specifically, I mean, it just helps us. It helps us safely bond with each other, and it makes life more fun.
And yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Part of the play aspect for babies is about development of coordination and language, you know, babbling and things like that. It's sort of experimenting in a way in order to eventually gain these skills. And I think that's kind of the way that I think about play in my own business. Like I kind of allocate a certain amount of time for unstructured reverie, for I'm going to read this book that I'm super fascinated in, if this qualifies as play, read this book that I'm very super fascinated in because it's gonna feed me in some way. Or I'll organize an improv workshop, which I do sometimes. And part of it is to improve my creativity. And you can do these kind of unstructured things and they can actually build skills that you can use for actually goal-directed activity. Is that correct?
Yeah, totally. And so how long have you been doing improv?
I first went to improv, gosh, I guess I was going to improv more than 10 years ago back in San Francisco. I was going to kind of little comedy workshops and I would go to the improv drop-ins. And then when I moved to Chicago, I started taking improv at Second City. Well, I mean, in addition to improv, I took sketch writing and I took storytelling and, I found it to be, you know, personally, I'm not actually a fan of improv as an art form. I have to admit, like I do not enjoy very much watching improv. I would never submit somebody to watching me improvise. But yeah,
it can be painfully awkward to watch.
Yeah. And I guess I think that a lot of times with improv, the audience gives credit to the actors for having just made that up. But one, they're not just making it up. They're inside of a structure. It's not like it's just coming out of thin air. I prefer to watch something scripted, but as a creative process, it's been fantastic. So I understand you do improv as well, right?
Mm-hmm. And I kind of used it as that as well. Not as much with the intention of this is a creative process, but I did a little bit of performing in front of an audience and I didn't like that as much. I wasn't doing it to like you said, subject people to my humor or my spontaneity or whatever. It was more of, I found the mindset and the spirit that it got me into was so great and healthy. And it just being able to basically be silly and fail and get really comfortable with failure. Yes. I found it tremendously beneficial for that part of the creative process, especially in speaking. It was so nice to repeatedly die on stage, so to speak, and be safe. And I just don't really have that fear anymore at all when it comes to public speaking.
That resonates so much with me. I mean, I was thinking the exact same thing, is that I've done a fair amount of public speaking. And if it weren't for being in improv classes and, okay, I do this scene and it turns out really terrible, but I realize that I'm still alive. I can then get on a stage and know that something terrible can happen. Actually, it happened to me once in Singapore. We did the whole sound check, we did the tech check and everything. I got up on stage and all my slides were just like Russian characters. And it was a design presentation, mind you. And thankfully, I had a little bit of improv chops, so I could improvise and, you know, make fun of the situation in a way, but then also give the presentation while the tech people scrambled to try to fix the things. So yeah, it's extremely fun.
Did you take on the persona of like an angry Russian?
I don't know if it was actually Russian, but it was characters that I did not recognize that had just replaced all the characters in the whole slide. And it was upsetting because we had done the tech check and, you know, transferred the fonts and all that stuff. But I think I learned my lesson to just go with a PDF instead of the Keynote file in situations like that.
That lesson just paid for itself for many listeners who are like, oh, PDFs, why hadn't I thought of that?
Are you a PDF presenter?
I typically am, unless in, and I don't know about you, I make changes always until like the last second. And then I'm like, okay, now I'm handing it off as a PDF. So it multiple iterations of PDFs.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I guess it's been a while since I talked, so I'm certainly not one to change it too much too late, because I always like to feel like I'm prepared or something. I'm afraid that like
that's the thing. It's like I don't like to give the exact same speech twice. I try and vary it up to kind of keep myself on my toes and see if there's always like I always trying to find some way to improve it.
Yeah,
and occasionally that pays off huge. Like I remember just kind of on a whim, I was like, the day of. I was like, I want to talk to somebody about the problems that I'm going to cover in my talk. And I just was like, do you mind if I film this? And I just held it in my hand and filmed her talking. And she was like, not only one of the most popular people at the event, she gave phenomenal answers and went in like deeply vulnerable explanations of how she was dealing with the problem. And I was like, oh my God, I have to incorporate her as the hero of the speech to show like, you know, because she had successfully overcome the problem. So I started with a video clip of her, ended with a video clip of her, and she was like the celebrity of the speech, which was great for me because, you know, it's exhausting to give a talk and then to have 20 people approach you and want to talk with you and have an engaged conversation after. So everyone was like going to her and I was like, yes, this is awesome.
You outsourced the... But that you were able to do that because you were willing to be present with what was being offered to you. You were willing to yes and what was in front of you. You weren't stuck. You weren't married, I guess, to what you had previously come up with.
Totally. And that's the main principle of improv. It's the main principle one of the main principles of Buddhism. Like everything changes, accept it and don't cling to anything too tightly.
It's like when we were talking earlier and then we could hear your daughter and I had my next question sitting in front of me, but hey, your daughter's talking, so let's let's talk about her, you know?
I appreciate your graciousness on that. Yeah.
Of course. I think it is yes and. I mean, I think that's something to always work on. So how did you come to write this? I mean, you have two books about play now. How did mm-hmm. play become your thing?
So I didn't really consciously intend for it to. It actually started in a different place where I struggled for about a year and a half, 2 years. This was back in between 2010 and 2012-ish with crippling, debilitating anxiety. And I just kept that bottled up and sort of to myself. I kind of walled it up and tried to work my way through it. And it hit a point where I really felt like I was going crazy. And I, you know, I it's almost weird to describe now because I'm disconnected from that experience. But at the time, it felt like I was living in my own hell, my own personal hell. And I was isolating myself in my apartment in San Francisco because I didn't want my friends or my peers to catch any of my weird energy. You know, I was struggling with panic attacks at some point. I remember being so embarrassed because I had dinner with a friend who was visiting from out of town, and I spilled my water all over because my hands would shake so much. Like I was just so frazzled, and I'd never experienced anything like that for such an extended period. Like I was always in fight or flight mode. And, you know, I visited the doctor. They prescribed me anti-anxiety meds that I ended up throwing away because it was like the side effects of these outweigh what I'm trying to solve. And, you know, I tried everything to sort of overcome it, whether it was, you know, meditation. I was meditating up to 2 hours a day at some point. I was doing yoga, therapy. I went to multiple therapists, taking every supplement that you're supposed to. Like, you go down the list, everything that they recommend to people who struggle with anxiety, you know, different types of exercise, diets, flotation tanks, psychedelics, all this stuff. I tried it. None of it really worked. And I was so frustrated because things would work for maybe a day or two and they would return. And I could not figure it out for the longest time. And I was never like suicidal, but I did hit a point where I thought, if life continues like this, I don't know if I can make it, because this is just a never-ending series of feeling miserable all day long and just like not liking being in my own body. And
so you tried pretty much everything except for did you start to consider doing the prescription drug routes after you tried some?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like I tried it. I did not like how it made me feel.
You took the prescription stuff.
Yeah. And the research that I did further on it, because it was like, that felt terrible. There were just too many. And I know the analytical and science-based people would be like, well, a lot of people really are helped by those drugs. I just came across far too many strong anecdotes that I was like, you know what? The risk is not worth it to me. And I heard them from friends of mine who were like, I've been on those for years and like they stopped working to the point of effectiveness 2 months in, and I'm trying to get off of them and I'm having a hard time. So I just didn't view them as a viable long-term solution. So I hit a point where I was like, okay, I got myself into this somehow. I don't fully understand it, but I can probably get myself out. And at my friend's house, just by happenstance, he owns thousands of books. He has the most amazing library. And I was looking through his library and I stumbled across a title called Play by Stuart Brown. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. And I started reading it and I sat down and I read it all in one sitting. And there was a point in the book where I just felt like, oh my gosh, I'm such an idiot. I didn't recognize that like this was what I've been deprived of for years, what I've unknowingly deprived myself of continuously. And I started laughing because I realized like I'd kept myself in that prison of life is serious, life is work. Work is a task that you are forcing yourself to do in order to pay the bills. And if you don't, if you're not successful, if you don't become rich, like you're a failure. And like somehow along the way of growing up, I'd rewritten the script about what work should be and how life needed to be. It became less about living and more about productivity and efficiency and all this stuff. And it just wasn't who I was when I was growing up. And it put me in a very serious state of mind. And I remember my parents were like, we wish you weren't so serious. Like, you become so serious and we never knew you to be serious. And
how did that happen?
You know, I think it was a bunch of different things. I was working in San Francisco. I'd gotten myself in a couple high profile positions back to back. I'd worked with a number of best selling authors. I had a full time position with Tim Ferriss, which was amazing, and it actually, like, that for years I was great in. There came a point though where I was given the responsibility, which I'd asked for, of organizing this huge event that Tim put on with 100 plus people coming in from around the world who'd paid $10,000 each to come to this event. And I was like 24, 25 at the time. And my event planning experience was like planning keggers in college type thing. I felt very nervous that I was going to screw everything up. And so at some point I realized, like, I need as much time as possible. I can't fall asleep during this event in case something screws up. So I secretly ordered modafinil and abused the hell out of that during the event. And modafinil, for those who don't know, was originally... its intended purpose was to keep military fighter pilots awake for up to 3 days at a time on their missions. And now it's prescribed to people with narcolepsy to prevent them from spontaneously falling asleep. And I took it for 4 days, slept a total of 6 hours over the course of 96 hours, which is stupid, really dumb. And after that, I remember my body started really kind of freaking out. And then I had a series of like technical emotional traumas kind of all hit all at the same time. You know, a close friend of mine attempted suicide. A family member died, and the deadline for our next book got pushed back 6 months, which was sort of one of the straws that broke the camel's back for me. I was just in a weak, fragile physical state and emotional state after that event and after all those things happened in like a 48-hour period or something. And I just hit a wall. I quit, took a couple months off to reassess, then joined I know this is a long-winded answer, but I joined an app startup. We did well. We worked on a launch for a few months. So I went into another launch, which is really stressful.
Launches are stressful for sure. Yeah.
They take years off your life. And after that, I was still in the same state, except I was worse off. So, it was a culmination of a lot of different things. But it was like at the end of the day, I was enforcing a lot of these like mental and emotional rules on myself. I wasn't completely honest with anybody about how I felt. I wasn't taking good care of myself. You know, I was abusing drugs, alcohol, caffeine, especially to kind of power myself through the week and to numb out and decompress on the weekend. And so I did it to myself. Is the answer? Well, is the short answer?
Yeah, I'm wondering, do you have any insight into, you know, what was your identity then? What was it that you valued that, you know, caused you to allow yourself to get to that point?
Yeah, so I viewed myself as somebody who was working on very important things. You know, I just had an inflated sense of self-importance. And it's kind of weird when you have people around you cheering you on and telling you that, like, oh, you're doing really, you know, inspiring work, or boy, you're going places, kid, type thing. And so I think that was a big component of it, is like, if I'm not successful, like I just felt like I was never going to be sort of successful enough.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm really excited to have Skillshare back on the show as a sponsor of Love Your Work. I know that you will love Skillshare because you're a Love Your Work listener, and Love Your Work listeners naturally love to learn. And if you aren't familiar with Skillshare, it is an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in business, marketing, entrepreneurship, technology, and more. They have everything. A class that I personally really enjoyed is called The Writer's Toolkit, 6 Steps to a Successful Writing Habit. It is by author and screenwriter Simon Van Boy, and it will help you get into the writer's mindset.
So, you know, in surgeon's work, it's blood and things moving and like, you know, it's not like working on a sketch from Grey's Anatomy. So just get used to the fact that you're going to be in the gore, in the trenches, and nothing's going to feel like it's working, probably.
Join the millions of students already on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. 99 cents. You can't even buy a decent pen for that price. Anyway, that is right. Skillshare is offering Love Your Work listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork. Again, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork to start your 2 months now. If you're a creative entrepreneur, you need more than just a beautiful website. You need a powerful website. Success isn't just getting your products online. It's getting your products into the hands of the customers who will love them. I'm honored to have Weebly sponsoring Love Your Work. With Weebly, you don't just get an easy-to-build website with great-looking templates. And by the way, as a designer, I have to say, Weebly's templates are stunning. With Weebly, your website is not just beautiful. You also get tons of tools to help you turn that website into a business. This means features to help promote your products, process payment, manage inventory, send marketing campaigns, and get discovered by new customers. You know, stuff that gets you paid. Stuff at the intersection of your love and money Venn diagram. Weebly is offering 15% off just for Love Your Work listeners at weebly.com/loveyourwork. That's right. As a fan of Love Your Work, go to weebly.com/loveyourwork. That's Weebly, weebly.com/loveyourwork. And you'll get 15% off when you sign up for your online store. Weebly, more than just a beautiful website. Was it kind of abrupt, you going from whatever you were doing before to working on these things that were high profile and important? You know, you were launching New York Times bestselling books. Was that such an abrupt change that you had difficulty recalibrating your identity when you found yourself in that position?
That's a good question. And I don't know if it was about I think you're right, actually. So I was a college graduate living in my parents' basement in Colorado. It was 2008, so it was the recession. I was 21 and I was trying to get a job. And I didn't know many entrepreneurs in Colorado growing up. I was trying to get into a marketing agency and that collapsed during the recession. And so I hit a point where I was like, I am so tired of applying for jobs that I don't want and not even getting a response from these employers. Screw it. I'm just going to do things that I want to do. I'm going to create projects that I actually would enjoy doing. And I'm going to offer to help people that I admire who are doing great work for free. And I think that's originally how you and I made our first connection through Ramit Sethi, because I started helping him out with some video stuff on his site. And then his book launch was coming up. And it just snowballed quickly from there. I became known as a guy who helps authors, which is how I started working with other authors.
Yeah, I feel like I can relate to that because, yeah, you didn't know entrepreneurs growing in Colorado. I grew up in Nebraska. I didn't know entrepreneurs. Found myself in Silicon Valley. You know, I remember I got prescribed an anti-anxiety medication one time, and I remember going to the pharmacist, and fortunately, the pharmacist was like, "Okay, this is very addictive, so you know, take it if you need it. Just know that it's addictive." And so I never took it. I wonder if part of it was just that contrast of, well, I'm in Silicon Valley, because growing up for me, it was like people who do these high profile things, they're doing books, they're in Silicon Valley, or they're, you know, even go to an Ivy League school like Stanford or Harvard or something like that. Those weren't flesh and blood people to me growing up. That was people in movies. Those weren't real people.
Yep. Yeah.
Is that something? Me too. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you know, the entrepreneurs that I did meet, so I would volunteer at like investor days and stuff in Colorado. And it was still like, okay, now these are real people, but I don't understand anything they're talking about. So it was like, even though they became flesh and blood, it was still like, there's this barrier to get into, there's this second language now that I have to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's such an adjustment to go from that, you're not around people like that, there aren't people like that in your life, and then suddenly now you're this person who, you know, maybe you have an audience or something. You're like, oh, I'm like kind of famous now, I guess. I don't know. Like, who am I?
Yeah. It was bizarre. And I'm glad you're asking about this because literally no one ever asks about this. It just is like this period of my life. But it was bizarre because you go from kind of coasting at your normal speed to when working with Tim, it's like, you're operating at a different speed. You go from riding on your bike to being in a high powered jet, basically. Mm-hmm. Literally in some instances where you're like, oh, I'm on a plane now, going somewhere. So, it was a really exciting time in my life. Don't get me wrong. Like I do not paint that transition at all as anything but positive, like glowingly positive. It was amazing. And I was both incredibly fortunate and I worked my ass off to get into that position. It was a crazy time.
So you find yourself in that position, you find yourself with this anxiety, you're trying all these different things, you're just not able to kick it. You're even trying the prescription medications and you discover this book. Is that the moment? Or was there
it was about as clear, and I know it's tempting in narratives to like paint those clear moments, but and life is not always like that. But for me, it really was this transitional moment where I realized, okay, this is the one thing I haven't tried, which is to not only incorporate playful or to incorporate play back into my life. So literally the act of play, and doing things that you grew up doing. So for me, it was catch, home run derby, building things with my hands, improv, which I did a lot with friends of mine in various situations, doing film, that sort of thing. So I started literally building that into my schedule. But also is the aha moment of, oh my gosh, I'm viewing the world as a prison rather than a playground. Mm-hmm. Or a competing ground, a proving ground, as my friend Gwen Gordon likes to call it, where I'm just constantly trying to prove myself rather than, and I realized like all my success, so to speak, the reason I was able to get myself in that position in the first place was because I started viewing work as an opportunity to do the game that I wanted to do. The friends that I had, my best friends, were not because I met them at a networking event or I gave them my business card. You know, it was because we played a lot together. We had fun together. And so it was just realizing like, wow, I'd completely neglected this part of my life, this part of my personality of who I am. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't disappeared. It's still there. I've just neglected it. And what's going to happen when I reintroduce it?
It kind of makes me wonder, I mean, we've touched on this a little bit. It makes me wonder kind of what drove you into having the type of drive that you did in your work. I know like for myself, I came to realize at one point that the creative work that I did, I became good at creative work because I did it more as a salve, for... If I wasn't feeling happy, you know, and then so when I finally found success in that, then it was there was a realization of now for one I'm successful at this, and so I kind of should be happy. And also, I've made myself miserable in working so hard at some of this stuff. How can I find joy in this? Was there anything that you think drove you into pushing yourself so hard? Was there something that you were reacting to?
That's a good question. I think on the one hand, it was initially probably just driven by fear of losing that opportunity. Like, okay, I got myself in the seat. I don't want to fly out. And then it became a competence thing. It feels good when you realize you are competent at something and you have confidence, and maybe it gets mixed with a dash of arrogance if you hadn't had a fall on your face failure at that point, which at a certain point I hadn't. I kind of felt like I was on top of the world. Mm-hmm. But having those humbled me, and the anxiety was a blessing in many ways because it forced me to look at how I had become, even though I was in denial of it for a while.
Switching gears a bit, working with Tim Ferriss, what are the things that you think that you learned from working with Tim?
Oh, a lot. Well, the best place to start is I wrote a post called The 12 Lessons Learned While Marketing the 4-Hour Body. And that is a great resource for anybody who wants like a clear, articulate, extended answer of everything I learned about marketing the book with him and all that. I've had this question put to me a number of times over the years, and you got to understand, I was stupid in that I didn't journal during that period. And if I could do anything over, it would be to journal. Having said that, I'll take a stab at a few of the things. Like, I don't have a canned answer to this question because I learned so much. The biggest thing, honestly, that Tim really taught me was just expanding my mind on what's possible. And I think anybody who's read any of his books can testify to that. I mean, I met so many people or interacted with so many people who'd had their lives completely transformed from the ground up thanks to what Tim put out there. And I asked him at some point, I was like, how are you, like, what is it about your books that empowers people, it equips them? You know, there are books out there called like The 7-Day Weekend that are very similar in message and tone to the 4-Hour Work Week. I've seen a number of books come out that are similar in their message as the 4-Hour Work Week. But Tim really, he puts himself through the thing. He tells the story, and he uses himself as the guinea pig, and then he lays out his results, and then he lays out his recipe. And so he's like a chef for entrepreneurs, I think, or not a chef, but somebody who's giving a true cookbook to entrepreneurs. And that I don't think had really been done at the level of detail that he, until he wrote the 4-Hour Work Week, at least not to my memory. I can't think of anybody who really detailed everything and gave all the resources and gave his entire playbook the way Tim did. And you can see that in the DNA of some of the blog posts that you see now of entrepreneurs posting, like how I had an $86,000 launch or how we raised, you know, X million dollars. Like, people are so open to sharing their results, their stories and everything now, because a rising tide floats all boats. And Tim has created more millionaires than anybody I've seen. And you could say somebody like Jeff Bezos, who gave a platform to people, or Steve Jobs, who gave a platform. Like, obviously those guys did as well, but man, as a one-man band, Like Tim's the man. You know, it's hard to top him.
I remember one of the things standing out for me in reading the book was I remember seeing like samples of emails, and there might be like a footnote at the end of a sentence, and then it was an explanation of what this sentence is about. And I remember that level of detail that particularly was lighting my brain up in reading that. Was there any other details that you think really brought it to life?
Sure. So let's see. With a 4-hour work week, Tim doesn't. I don't know if Tim's ever talked about this aspect. I can't recall. But I think the title of the book is one of the most brilliant book titles ever. For numerous layers. On the surface, obviously, like controversial, conversation worthy. 4-hour work week, like that, everybody's got an opinion about that, right?
Yeah, it's something that you can easily have an objection to, while at the same time being like, yeah, I want that.
Right. Like, is that possible? So on the surface there, like that's a powerful title. On a deeper level, if you study phonetics and how, certain titles, certain names are really powerful and attractive to people because they like saying them. Coca-Cola is a great example of this, is one of the strongest brand names because it's alliteration, the K noise is fun to say, and it rhymes.
So do you mean like for an hour, are they kind of rhyme, and then
kind of rhyme.
And then the
work week, there's week.
Alliteration I think is very important there.
Yeah, so words start as sounds. They're not the letters. They're not the constructed things that we've written down. They're also how we say the thing. Mm-hmm. So 4-hour work week is fun. It's memorable. It's enjoyable to say. And I think this is something that we kind of forget to take into consideration, especially when naming products and stuff online, is you want to have the thing that is it has the perfect descriptor. But that's not always, like there's multiple elements to it. So I thought that title was just brilliant on those deeper levels.
Did that influence?
It doesn't get the weight that I think it deserves.
So did that influence the way that you've titled your books?
Play It Away. It definitely influenced, the rhyming element. It's a literal memorable. I think I was like, they might think pray it away, which, I was afraid actually to call it that at first. Cause I was like, I don't want anyone to think that it has anything to do with like, you remember like pray the gay away and all that stuff. Like I just didn't, I was a friend of mine originally suggested play it away. The same guy actually, Tucker Max, who had the book, play in his apartment. And so I was a little hesitant at first, but I really like the title. I think it's a really solid title. And then Play for a Living, I couldn't think of anything that better described what the philosophy was of that book. And frankly, I didn't even expect the book to necessarily like exist ever. Because it was just a complete, it's not a written book. It's a art book that roughly 50 artists around the world all collaborated on and contributed to. And I just never really fully expected it to come together. It was just like, if this comes together, awesome. If not, we'll figure out a way to utilize the work that was done and give those artists credit. But
yeah, it came together. I was definitely blown away by all the beautiful illustrations in there. I mean, there's just, how many illustrations are there?
75.
Okay, I was going to guess it was in the hundreds or something.
Yeah.
But I also like how on Play It Away, it's an anxiety, it's a book for anxiety, but anxiety is in the subtitle, so it can still be searched for. But, you know, a book with anxiety in the title would not so well pass what I call the cocktail party test.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? That was the other thing. It couldn't have. So this was the reason I wrote Play It Away was I was actually working on another book called Free Work, which I never published because when I gave it to friends, they were like, dude, this is a mess. and the book isn't structured properly. But this one section on you overcoming your anxiety, it's a good section, but it doesn't deserve to be in the book. It just doesn't make sense there. So I posted part of that section on my blog. And for the last 5 years, that post has been the number one result on Google if you search for anxiety cure or cure anxiety. You know, it flips every now and then with health.com, but generally speaking, it's the top result. And just the response I got from it, this was before, you know, people were posting anxiety confessionals on YouTube and like,
it seemed like it might have been a few years after your book came out that, you know, Tim Ferriss first posted about his own mental health and it was clearly like a very difficult thing for him to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's
nobody was doing that.
It was super brave that he did that. And it's still a very heavily stigmatized thing. Like Australia is considered one of the prime examples of a country that really does a great job with making mental illness, such as anxiety, depression, into something that's not super heavily stigmatized. It's still stigmatized there. It's still something that's very difficult to talk about. So I posted that. It blew up. It continues to get between 500 and 1,000 people around the world each day coming to it. People who have a difficult time identifying with the fact that they're struggling with this issue. And I wrote the book for them, basically.
I love that it came out of another book idea. I had that happen to myself. I was writing a book and I was editing it. And then the part that I edited out was like, oh, wait, this is a book. I need to say this. That became the heart to start.
There you go. Yeah. Books.
So whatever happened to Free Work?
Free Work is, it's something I still consider I might do. I talked with a publishing house recently about it as an idea of like, you're basically creating the door of your choosing, the one that you want to walk through. You create the opportunity rather than trying to get your foot in the door. You create the door and then kick it in. And that's sort of the concept behind the book. And I just didn't feel super enthused about it as I was explaining it to them. I was like, yeah, I just don't, you know, like I kind of said what I needed to say when I wrote Recession Proof Graduate, and maybe I'll retitle that at some point so it can, you know, feed a broader audience. But at this point, it's not so front of mind for me, you know?
I mean, it's always a good test of like, how does it feel to tell somebody about this book idea?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So thank you so much, Charlie, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Everybody should Play It Away and Play for a Living, Recession Proof Graduate. Is there anywhere where you would like for people to find you?
Yeah. You can sign up for my email list, charliehone.com. I don't email super often, but I just try and hit people up with value and whenever I can. And then of course I'm on Amazon, and I also am head of video for a company called Book in a Box. And we help authors who help people who have an idea and just don't have the time or the patience to sit down and write out the entire book. We help them with that process.
And longtime listeners have heard Tucker Max talk about Book in the Box right here on the show as well. So
exactly.
Go check all of that out. Again, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Is Love Your Work helping you find the intersection on your love and money Venn diagram?
Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation to make you into the person that you want to be? If so, we, together, you and I, can make this the show that we want it to be. I'm trying to make a nourishing and thoughtful show, and I could use your help with that. Please donate to the show. Just a coffee a month will help support the hosting and production of this show. Just a coffee a month will help spread Love Your Work's message, helping more people live a balanced life with a healthy definition of success. To donate, visit our Patreon page at kadavy.net/donate. Patreon is a platform that lets you support creators like me, vote with your dollars, and keep Love Your Work going at kadavy.net/donate. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at kadavy.net/donate. That's kadavy.net/donate. Love Your Work is made possible by top supporters, such as Arif Akhtar. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Kadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Kadavy, Inc.